This is Dr. Philip E. Johnson, who's with us this morning, and I want to introduce him to you and thank you for being here with us. Phil Johnson's a graduate from Harvard and University of Chicago Law. He served as law clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren in the U.S. Supreme Court and taught law for more than 30 years at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of numerous books, including Darwin on Trial, Defeating Darwinism, Reason in the Balance, The Wedge of Truth, The Right Questions, and Objections Sustained. He is recognized as the founder of the Intelligent Design Movement, and we could go on and on with a list of things that he's accomplished. My wife and I know him really because of his wife, Kathy Johnson, who's with us this morning. And of course, we knew of him, and I had read his books previous to meeting him. But his wife, Kathy, has the most remarkable library in the basement of their house with, I believe it's 31,000 volumes of children's books. And this library is open for children to come. And I have to say, it's one of my kids' favorite places in the Bay Area to go to that library. There's toys and themes and wonderful things. And so that's been a blessing to them. And through that, we've gotten to know Phil Johnson as well, and that's been great. We're going to have a time together, kind of an interview-style question-and-answer format. And I sort of had this nightmare this week. I imagine the two of us sitting up here debating. And I just am so thankful sitting here this morning that I'm not debating Dr. Johnson. That would be much an unfair fight. Not that we would have anything to debate about it, I don't know, in the first place. But so thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Pleasure to be here. See all these wonderful people, especially the children, the grown-ups too.
Good. So, Phil, you came to faith, and he's asked me to call him Phil, so that's what I'm going to do. You came to faith in Jesus Christ later in life, and I wonder if, just to start off with, you could share with us that story of how you came to faith in Jesus Christ.
Well, I had gone to, I'd been brought up in a nominal Christian family. I'd gone to Sunday school because that was the kind of thing that mothers in those days thought that children ought to do. We used to drop my father off at the golf course on the way to church on Sunday morning. And as you can imagine, this experience left me with a lifelong love for the game of golf and a conviction that to go play golf was the thing you did on Sunday morning after you got big enough that your mother couldn't tell you what to do anymore. And that's what I did. And I went away to college at a very young age. At 17, I was somewhat immature, went well far away from home to Harvard in the Boston area, and thought I had left all that small-town upbringing behind me, and I was prepared to be, for the rest of my life, an agnostic like all the other people around me, and that, as we think of it, that the herd of independent minds that you find at a great university. All these independent thinking people thinking the same way and arriving at the same conclusions. So I wanted to be part of that crowd. That was part of my immaturity, is that I was heavily subject to peer pressure and the pressure of the environment I was at, and I thought I was thinking independently. So then I had determined that I would spend the rest of my life in the great universities, perhaps become a professor, and because that seemed to be a relatively easy life. The work involving stuff that I was naturally good at and not very much stuff that I wasn't good at or didn't want to do. And that, so I thought of that as the culmination of a perfect life and was quite satisfied with that for a while. It seemed to be working well for me. I went to law school. Found that I had a great gift for taking law school exams. That doesn't seem all that important to me now, but at the time it was the most important thing in the world. It was the measure of a person's worth, how well they could do in law school. Of course, the people around me in law school all thought the same way, so that gave me an actually puffed up ego. I went to got out to California as law clerk to the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. At that time, the most prestigious state court judge in the country, Roger Trainer, who had previously been a professor at the law school at the University of California at Berkeley, popularly called Bolt Hall. From Judge Trainer, I went on to the U.S. Supreme Court to Earl Warren, so things still seem to be going well for me, and I had no reason to rethink the path that I was on. I went from the Supreme Court clerkship right away to a professorship at Bolt Hall, and living in this marvelous community with its wonderful climate, scenery, all those good things, except for water, of course, but I didn't have any problem with that at the first, and then we I was married, had two children, a daughter with my first wife, and then a Korean a son whom we adopted. Everything seemed to be going just fine. And then my marriage collapsed. My wife left me, another one. For a while, I was single parenting the two children and going somewhat crazy with it. Then my wife asked to have the have them. We had joint custody. She asked to have them for some time, and they went with her, and so I was kind of on my own. And I had this time a sense, for the first time in my life, a sense of failure, and a sense of instead of being on a path of ever greater success, I was seemed to be in a treadmill into a blind alley, because I had experienced a failure in my marriage. I didn't think I was doing too well as a parent, and as far as the brilliant legal career, it seemed no longer satisfying. My business was applying good thought, logical thought, teaching clear thinking to law students about the minutiae of the criminal law and all of that. Now, that was good for a while, but eventually began to bore me. I thought, well, I wasn't satisfied with the topics that I was addressing. I wanted to address the real things. What is real? What isn't real? What the big issues of life, the great mysteries I wanted to address, that I hadn't done that. Now, at this time, in this kind of in-between state, still an agnostic, I fell in with some wonderful Christian people, a neighbor, and a minister of Bill Beatty of the College Avenue Presbyterian Church, and his wife and family became friends with them. It seemed to be my destiny to fall in with new people and Christian people at moments of crisis, and so there I that's what I did, and decided that this was something I liked, that I wanted to be a Christian. So you might say at that time I accepted Jesus, became a Christian, although I would qualify that by saying in my case it's been a kind of long-term project rather than overnight business. I retained a great deal of what's sometimes called the old Adam in a new life, and gradually worked through. It isn't so much that I became attracted to Christianity as that I became skeptical about everything else. My passage to belief was rather naturally through unbelief and doubt, and that is and how my life has been. I became so skeptical of all the things that I had believed in. See, you can be a skeptic about some things, but not everything, or you go crazy because you've got nothing to rest your life on. So in order to be skeptical about things, like, say, Christianity, you have to rest
Hold on to that thought just a minute, because I want everybody to hear what you're saying, and your microphone has slipped down, so I'm going to put it back.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I'm always in need of help on the little things like that. Those are what are hard for me, the simplest things.
Okay.
I addressed all these questions of doubt after I made a first commitment to Christ. I think, why are all these other people that I know in the university world skeptical about this? Why do they think it's old-fashioned stuff no longer valid for today? This led me to thinking about the theory of evolution, Darwinism, as I call it, and that it seemed to me that a key to understanding why the world thinks it has passed the Christian faith by is that they have a new creator. Instead of God as the creator, it is the processes of nature, unguided and unassisted, who did all the work of creating. So at this point, it's not so much that this way of thinking proves that God does not exist, as it proves that there's no need for God to exist. If he exists, existing is just about all the poor fellow has ever done. He has never found gainful employment. That nature can do and did do all the work of creating on its own. That this is taken for granted not only as a theory, but as a basic fact about the universe and the world. Part of the furniture of reality, as it were, so that it is somewhat close to insanity to deny it. Now, that made me all the more interested in finding the weak point, if there was one, in this wonderful scheme of creation by nature. At that time, Kathy and I went off to live in England for a year. I was on a sabbatical from Berkeley and had a visiting professorship at the University College London. So we lived in London for a year. And it seemed that, once again, destiny was in my way. The first night that we were in England, we stayed at a countryside bed and breakfast. And when we came to breakfast in the morning, there was a Canadian couple there that we sat with. On their way, they'd spent a year in England and were on their way back to Canada after the year. We asked them what they had been most impressed with in England, and they said quite forthrightly in return, "We went to the home of Charles Darwin, that great man. That was the most important and awe-inspiring thing that we saw in England in a year." It was like it was a great shrine. It might have been a medieval pilgrim talking about the shrine of some saint with his relics that they had visited, as if it were a new religion. So this seemed like a meaningful sign of what this year was going to be like. That we had first heard about the central importance of Charles Darwin in the visit of this Canadian couple who were sharing their whole experience very frankly with us, then it happened that the first day that we came to London, I stumbled upon a bookstore where I found a book on creation and evolution by a physicist. And this was something what you would call an old Earth creationist. That is, he believed that the Earth was some billions of years old, and the universe some more billions of years old. He was not a six-day creationist or a young Earth creationist, as some are, but he believed quite firmly that the theory of evolution was unscientific, and that it was a philosophical dogma in the guise of a scientific theory and not reliable. He also told the story that I later picked up and used in chapter 11 of my first book on the subject, Darwin on Trial, the story of the centennial exhibition at the British Museum of Natural History, which has sometimes been called the Cathedral of Darwinism. It is a museum which from its very inception was devoted to promoting the theory of evolution and the mechanism that Charles Darwin gave to ascribe for how the evolution occurred. So that was the next step in my path to where I am now.
That's great. I was wanting to ask you about your career outside of the practice of law and the teaching of law, and so you have shared with us a little bit of that, and that's great. I want to also ask you a question about some of the things that have been happening in your life recently, and maybe we'll come back to some of these other questions as well. But when you were writing your last book, you suffered a stroke in the middle of writing that book. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about how that changed your understanding of your faith and how that affected your walk with the Lord and your viewing your vocation and your work and all of that.
Thank you a little bit about that. Andrew, for showing me the right path forward here. I rely on my interlocutor to keep the conversation on track and on time.
We're in trouble if that's the case.
You ask about the stroke. Well, that was at first a terribly frightening and destructive thing for my life. See, what I had all of my life, I had proceeded on the assumption that I had a very good mind, that this was confirmed for me by the fact that I did so well in school without working very hard, and then finally in law school and got to be a professor at quite a young age. So I thought this is what I really had faith in, is that my mind could work things out for myself, and that was enough. I was satisfied with that. And even after I became a Christian, I think that it is probable that my real faith was in that mind, that I thought, well, that's what's going to lead me forward. And Jesus is very nice, and God too, and we go I love these Christian people, but what I really rely on is my ability to solve problems with my mind. That's my where my faith lies. So the stroke, when it hit me, was hit me in the vulnerable part that I thought was the rock on which I could base my life. And I all of a sudden I found that the mind wasn't working as before, that it was vulnerable to a sudden catastrophic event. And so this frightened me a great deal. And then when I was sitting in the hospital, lying in the hospital bed shortly after this stroke had occurred, some friends gathered around the bed, one of them an excellent professional soprano that we know, long been an intimate friend of ours, who sang this great hymn about "On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand, All Other Hope is Sinking Sand." And this really meant something to me at that particular time, because I thought, what solid rock am I standing on? And is this mind on which I've relied so much sinking sand? Because I see how it can fail me at any moment. So one moment it's working fine, and then the next I'm totally confused and I don't know where I am. So that was a very disruptive event, and I had to think of a new life, the rest of my life, without the old mind working as it always had. And that this made me more than ever convinced that the important thing in life is not all of the skeptical questions that you can manage to invent about any faith. And I thought I was pretty expert at coming up with skeptical arguments about religion or anything else. So I had learned in all these years of legal training and professorial scholarly writing to be able to cast doubt on just about anything. But to cast doubt on one thing is to place your reliance on something else. So now I began to cast doubt on what I had been relying on all along. So what was the pillar that I could rely on? all this doubt was going on about me, and I thought, well, it seems to be that the solid rock on which I can stand is Christ and the plan of God for my life. But that's what really beckons me as the place to put my reliance. So I came out of the hospital with that, with a faith that had been much strengthened by the ordeal of doubt.
And we've been studying on this topic a little bit in a series called Thriving Amidst Uncertainty. And we've been looking at some scriptures that describe how a person thrives when things in their life, the circumstances in their life, are perhaps a bit uncertain. One of the things that I've appreciated so much about you as I've been able to visit with you is the joy with which you approach some of the uncertainty in your life. In fact, one of the first times that we came over, I asked what he'd been doing that day, and he said, "I just got back from playing basketball." And I know that that's one of the things that you do on a regular basis. But I was also curious in, you talk about the book of Job and how that was important to you in some of the days following your first stroke. And I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about how in reading the book of Job you were strengthened and encouraged, and maybe put some perspective and understanding on what was happening to you.
Well, I could imagine myself in the role of Job. That's rather easy to do when things are going very wrong for you, because that's the story of the book of Job, that Satan, the accuser, who is the all-time expert at skeptical argument, says to God, "Well, there's Job. He seems to be a very faithful man. He's praising you all the time. He is a man of God to the hilt, it seems. But, of course, he's praising God. Everything goes well for him all the time. He's rich and healthy and has all these wonderful children and the respect of everybody in the world. That's why he's grateful to God, that everything goes well. But what would he be like if things started to go wrong for him and he ended up in despair? Then he wouldn't be praising God. He'd be cursing you." They agree to try this out, and then Job has the experience of everything going wrong for him and losing everything, and he has to ask himself very deeply again and again, "Do I still love God? Do I still have any faith?" His wife even suggests to him, "Well, curse God and die," but he doesn't take that path. He gradually works his way through, and he asks for an answer to all of this, and finally the answer he gets isn't one that would satisfy everybody. God just assures him, "I'm here and I'm in charge." And yet that's enough for Job. If God is there, Israel hasn't gone out of existence or ceased to be the master of the universe, then Job can make his peace with the misfortunes that have come to him. And this he sees. So I had to do that with God. And a question came to me. I had wanted to address my dialectical skills to the question of what is real? What are the most important things in the world? The big questions of life rather than the details of the law. So what would be the biggest question in life of the kind that I could address? Is God real or imaginary? That is what I had been addressing and what I was writing this book about when it was interrupted and I thought I wouldn't be able to finish it. Well, that was so important to me too. Is God real or imaginary? Is God important or trivial? Well, I knew that the world of the intelligentsia in America and Europe that I was familiar with from the universities was that the only thing you need to know about God is that some people believe in him and other people don't. And that's basically all there is to be said. Is God real and important? Well, he's real and important to the people who think so, and he's not real and important to the people who don't. Which is another way of saying he isn't real or important at all. Although some people may imagine that he is. Just as Santa Claus is real enough to children on Christmas Eve, God is real and important when you think he is. And he's real and important to you, and that's okay, provided you don't bother other people with this idea and bore them. That was a question of questions that I was trying to introduce. And with a lot of help from Kathy, a lot of encouragement, I was able to finish a book there and be able to come back to that extent. And then I began to see a happy ending at the because of this very trying process. And as I became also much more and more competent physically, able to take the bus everywhere and walk everywhere. That was great.
And shoot baskets.
And even go off on a trip by myself. Mm-hmm. So I did go off on a trip to Southern California for a rather routine, pleasant meeting. Mm-hmm. And during this meeting, I had a second stroke. Just for no reason at all, as far as I or our doctor at Kaiser could say, it just happened. I had had one stroke, and statistically, people who've had one stroke are much more likely to have a second one than they were to have a stroke beforehand. So the lesson from this is, if you want to have two strokes, the way to do it, to start about it, is to have first one. Then you're on the path. And
Makes perfect sense.
So I did. And that was a real a doubt after that. I was hit with a full-fledged depression after I went into it. I felt that everything was wrong. Continually imagined the worst-case scenario. I was now going to have a third stroke. It would be bedridden. Mm-hmm. It would be much more difficult for Kathy to manage. And I would have to be put away somewhere at great expense. And so, well, everything was
following on that. One of the things that I've been able to observe a little bit is your relationship with your wife, Kathy. And we at this church, with the marriages that we have, want to encourage and support strong marriages. And that's just been something really special. Could you say a few words on how she has been important to you?
Kathy has been a great leader to me in all of this. And this is a new experience for me to have to rely on another person for leadership and authority, almost as if I were a small child again. Because the worst of it is, I think, that one of the normal incidences of post-stroke behavior is a certain orneriness or crankiness, a hot temper. And so I would explode often at things that happened. Kathy had to deal with that. And that gave me a bad conscience, too, because I knew it was wrong for me to make things any more difficult for Kathy than they already were in dealing with it. But with all that leadership and her seeing that I couldn't get excellent therapy, I was picked to be the demonstration patient in a college class for physical therapists at Samuel Merritt College at one of the hospitals here in the Berkeley Oakland area, and I found I really enjoyed being a professional patient. And it gave me a chance to sort of be, if not an instructor, at least an instructional aide to the budding therapist there, and the responsibility of letting them show off and develop their skills and being an encourager. The way to be an encourager was to do well, to improve. So I felt a responsibility to be, a professional responsibility, as it were, to improve. And I did improve a lot. And so I have found that the process of stroke rehabilitation with the second stroke has been a rewarding experience, the whole just as it was with the first one. So I was able to stop thinking about the worst case and stop imagining always that the worst possible thing was going to happen, and Instead, I got better and better, and now I shoot baskets every day, walk a half mile or every day, weather permitting, and this really is a tonic to my faith in all respects. I see this, that this improvement is possible, and that having a good attitude is a large part of it, and having a good wife is a large part of having a good attitude. Because I'm not allowed to have a bad one. So I have had to learn to accept a subordination when I am used to exercising leadership all my life. And that has been an experience that helps teach humility. You say a good thing about stroke rehabilitation is that there's a school in humility. So I say, whether I learned anything from it or not is not for me to say, but I can say that I've been to all of the classes. So that's a lot of college students and law school students can say. They don't know whether they learned anything, but they went to class and took notes.
There's something significant about that phrase that you keep saying, the good thing about stroke rehabilitation. And so you can see why I wanted him to come and share with us this morning on this topic. We see the power of Christ in you exuding from you as you have walked through this. And it's a beautiful thing.
It's not something I would recommend to anyone, having a stroke. On the whole, it's better to avoid it. But if it does happen to you, it's good to know that there can be a positive side to the whole experience. And that having a faith is a big tool towards reaching that positive side. And any doctor will say that. It's not giving in to the depression, as I was so frequently tempted to do. It seems one has an excuse just to give up and lie down. It's happened to me once, and it's happened to me again. It's hopeless, so why try to do anything? And I had to, with Kathy's help, to work my way out of that and into a state of positive faith.
So the other thing that's so wonderful is that you share that you did have those struggles with us, and you have had those struggles. That's an important thing, because the walk with Jesus is not one that's just always up and to the right and everything's perfect and wonderful.
It's been a long process for me. I feel I am not by nature the kind of person who becomes a Christian. I am more by nature a pragmatist who says, well, I'll figure things out. I just give me the tools and I can figure out a solution. That is my nature, but I saw that that wasn't working now, and I really needed to accept a leadership and to become teachable, which I had not been very good at being the humble learner, but I had to improve some at that in order to get through this this struggle, and that's the good side. And it teaches you something if you're willing to learn.
I want to ask one more question. We don't have a lot more time, but I want to ask you this, because you still really are working, and I know God has things for you to do and books for you to write and papers and things. And I was able to sit in the other evening and listen to you talking with one of your coworkers on an upcoming work. And I wanted to just ask you this question. Since we have you here, what do you see are maybe one or two of the most important questions that we should be asking right now as people who are seeking to follow Jesus Christ the best that we can?
Well, to start, I would say, what is good thinking and what isn't? And now for Christians to ask this question, I think the most important thing is Christian thought that starts out with God and his son, Jesus, and the resurrection, good thinking, or is it weak thinking? The world thinks that it's weak thinking. The influences all around us will tell us that it's weak thinking. It's the kind of thing that weak people have to rely on as a sort of crutch, but that strong people can do without. And it certainly is no necessary part of education. You can. A lot of this is caught from science, although this kind of thinking is no more prevalent in science than in a great many other fields of thought, subjects of thought. Probably the most atheistic department in most universities is the English literature department. not the physics department. You'll find that if you want to find Christians and a university faculty, go to the School of Engineering. Practical science, that is, applied science, is where you find them. But the impression gets around that scientific thinking, which is the standard of good thinking, is thinking that ignores God, that trivializes him. If it doesn't deny the existence of God, it puts God off in a corner where that you never get to. It succeeds by paying no attention to God. And the philosophy department will say that you can do that too in the area of morals and ethics. The less you pay attention to the Bible and to traditional Christian thought, the better. So that's the way that they think. So are they right? And is many Christians in academic life and professional areas have pretty much accepted tacitly the idea that their thinking is weak and that they should not delude themselves that they can have the confidence to question the governing modes of thought that dominate the intelligentsia of our society. Is that a justified thinking, or have they got something dead wrong? Now
that's a great mm-hmm. piece to end with, because I think in the books that I have read of yours, that has been the thing that I've walked away with oftentimes, is a sense of confidence.
That's what we're working on, and that's what you heard the conversation about with me and my junior colleague mm-hmm. in our study the other night.
And we're going to look forward for that book coming out and to seeing that available. I was excited to listen in on it. But I think that the idea that we can become followers of Jesus Christ, we can grow in our followership of Jesus Christ, and that does not mean that we have to somehow take our brain and set it up on the shelf and ignore what God has given us, is a very powerful statement. And I think you're absolutely right that too many times we have succumbed to pressure, external pressure, and thought that we needed to do that when in fact we don't. In fact, if God truly is the author of all reason to begin with, then we can dig deep and ask tough questions and doubt and wrestle through and grapple.
Well,
and
that's what many homes, much greater schooling parents and children are learning and working out from the beginning. I see them as great heroes in society. Your wife Jody being one of my favorites. I think the people I admire the most that I meet are homeschooling moms. And they tend to have wonderful children, and that's certainly the case with your family.
No, we don't have to do that. I have to say, the first time we were over at their house, I thought, oh, this is great. I've got 15 questions that I'm going to ask him. And I asked him one or two questions, and each time he would start to answer the question, then he'd turn away and say, but Jody, tell me more about homeschooling. That's what I'm really interested in. That's great. Anyway, we're going to leave it at that, although I know we've got a lot more thoughts and questions, and you've provoked us to some great thinking. And I hope that we will take the testimony that you are not only of clear thinking, but confidence in thinking as Christians, followers of Jesus Christ. I hope that we'll walk away with that. And if it would be okay with you, would you allow us to pray for you and for Kathy yes. this morning as we finish up?
Thank you.
Let's do that. Lord, we are so grateful for this man and Kathy also that you have brought into your service to proclaim your message, your good and great message, to do it with boldness and confidence, to do it with clarity of thought, to do it with love, with joy, and with a tenacity that we need to learn from and emulate as well. And I want to pray for Phil, for his health, that you would continue to heal his body and protect his body and continue to give him the strength, and Kathy as well, as she is part of this endeavor, to complete the tasks that you have in front of them. And we look forward to the fruit of those as they are completed. And we want to thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen.